Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, Emer Daly is back with the latest in health and wellness news. Jenny Keane on her most asked question as a sex educator. And as International Women's Day was this weekend, I'll be meeting Dr. Louise Fitzgerald, working to empower through education. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I definitely needed a slower paced week this week as the one before that was bonkers. I am bringing in a late New Year's resolution. Can I even call it that at this stage? It's a moment of reflection either way that I've realised I'm quite good at scheduling in what I commit to, but I'm brutal at looking at the week or a month as a whole. So I'll often say yes to way too many things in the 1 week just because I see a free space on the calendar. Now, I'd have to say it was all good stuff. I had work on, nights out, parent-teacher meetings. Things were coming at me from all angles. And I did get through it, dare I say. I enjoyed it all. But this week, I needed to rest and reset. And when I do something like that, I lean into the most simplest of things, from changing the bed sheets to using some of the nice products, I'm sure you all get them, as presents and gifts that just stay on a shelf. So be that a body cream or bath salts, they come out on a week like this. And I just try and get back to things that I know make me feel good. Nourishing dinners, early nights. So yeah, felt good to come back down to earth. And I'm still fairly reeling, I'd have to say, from the Future Fertility Show. I met Dr. Rahi Victory in person at the event. He was my guest on last week's show. And he and many other panellists and exhibitors that I met spoke of the issues within what has become an industry. And to think that people at one of the most difficult times of their life would be seen as purely revenue to some quarters is devastating to me. And I also met couples that had felt like that and lacked continuity of care. But information is empowering. I met lots of lovely supportive people looking to change this. So I do remain hopeful. So if you'd like to share your experience on your fertility journey, and I know many have had great success and support, be that with IVF, donors, or any pathways to parenthood. But I'd love to hear from you on this topic. The email address, as always, is aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, International Women's Day took place yesterday, March 8th. This year's focus was on promoting gender equality under the theme Accelerating Action. One gender disparity is within healthcare. Women's health is underfunded, under-researched and often misdiagnosed. Dr. Louise Fitzgerald is a GP and an activist for women's healthcare. And Louise joins me on the line now. Louise, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much.
Louise, when did you begin to realise that there was a disparity within women's healthcare?
I think really that probably goes back to the story I told at the National Women's Council event yesterday. Was all focusing on menopause and both my personal and professional experience of menopause. But that story goes back to when my mum went through menopause when I was a teenager, and she really struggled to get the help that she needed at that stage in terms of getting advice from GPs and getting the right treatment for that, because at that stage, HRT was something we weren't prescribing. And she felt quite powerless because she couldn't get the help that she needed. But I felt quite powerless because I was a teenager at that stage, but knew I wanted to be a doctor, but couldn't help her. And I knew then at that stage that when I was a doctor, I wanted to help women as much as I could. But fast forward to becoming a GP, and really menopause is talked about now, but you know, 10 years ago, even 6 years ago, we weren't talking about menopause in the way that we were. And certainly now I'm able to help women with menopause and perimenopause and getting help. But it's very much a disparity in terms of who can access that menopause care. So as you said, I do a lot of work around raising awareness in terms of women's health. And I do a lot of talks, especially to marginalized groups about accessing menopause care. So I think there really is, it's still very difficult for women to access menopause care and health, general health care. And sometimes when they go talk to a GP, they find that GPs don't want to talk to them about certain topics. And so a lot of the work I do is focusing on giving women their voice, telling them what resources to bring with them, and what information to bring with them to their GP to be listened. Because there are lots of resources available, but social media is a great thing in some ways, but it does have a lot of varying information on it. But there are some very robust resources available to women that are not for healthcare professionals. They're actually for the women themselves. And if you're information and education is empowerment, so having that information means then you can access healthcare.
And can we go back to your mum's story for a moment? Her experience with the menopause led to her leaving the workforce. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly how things would have played out. But had she got the necessary healthcare at the time, that might not necessarily have happened. And I know that's happening for so many women. So many women leave the workforce. And when it comes down to it, quite often it was due to symptoms of menopause.
Absolutely. So she was a dietitian, so really well qualified, working, you know, in a hospital setting or healthcare setting. And the main symptom she had really was hot flushes and anxiety. So she'd stopped driving places that she felt she used to be able to drive to. And there is some evidence, that soya milk can help with hot flushes. So she was drinking gallons and gallons of soya milk. And the soya milk can work for some people, but it doesn't work for other people. So at sort of the initial trial of her soya milk hadn't worked, it should have been stopped at that stage. But unfortunately, she couldn't get HRT, so her symptoms just got worse, and then she gave up the employment. Now, she subsequently got HRT and did really well with that. But at that stage, you know, she sort of made that decision, so she didn't go back to employment. But this is something I feel very strongly about. I do a lot of work on occupational health, so work-related health, and how health impacts your work. And I've been invited to the House of Commons for the 18th of March to discuss menopause in the workplace in the UK, and looking at policy on menopause in the workplace in the UK. And the UK is probably a little bit more ahead of Ireland in terms of looking at menopause in the workplace and how menopause can impact women in terms of, you know, working and their ability to work, but also their, you know, staying in the workplace. I think Ireland is looking at that, and we certainly have, you know, the private companies looking at doing courses within institutions and businesses as to how you can accommodate women with menopause. You know, there are policies within the HSC and certain hospitals certainly have policies, but we're probably a little bit behind in that compared to the UK. But this is something, it's not, you know, I think a lot of women say to me, I feel like I'm going crazy, or, you know, the person looked at me like I was going crazy. It's this, they think it's all in my head, but it's not. And it's certainly not. These are physical symptoms. They are psychological symptoms. It's a whole combination of symptoms that affects women and then unfortunately can impact them in work.
At the opposite end of the scale, if you will, I was at a fertility event last weekend, and there was talk at it about the secrecy and the silence around fertility journeys and the reticence that women feel to say, I am on a fertility journey, and women returning to work after really bad news, really big procedures. And I think this plays out again when it comes to perimenopause and menopause. Women don't want to put their hand up and say, me and my partner are trying for a baby, I'm pregnant, I'm on a fertility journey, I might be having perimenopause, because it's thought that it'll look like we're not fully committed to our jobs. And I think we need to change that conversation a lot.
Absolutely, absolutely. I was at a menopause talk last year, and there was a man speaking at it, and he was working in a company that does look at workplace programs to help employees around their health. But he was saying that the women need to speak first, that it has to be the women saying that they're going through menopause, that they're going through perimenopause, that they're struggling. And I think, and maybe he just didn't, maybe couldn't quite relate to where you'd be coming from as a woman, but, and having had some health issues myself and actually now being very much in the perimenopause myself, I think it's very hard as a woman to be the person to say it first. I think really it's about, you know, you don't have to use those words as such. If you're happy to use them, then that's great. But for some people to just be able to say, I'm having a difficult time, I think that's really important. but I think we shouldn't be labeling the woman or the female as the person that has to say it first. It has to be more of a change within the business that and the company, that, you know, that people can feel that they can say how they're maybe what their symptoms are or say what they're experiencing, but not have to use the specific words and not be the one that says it first. And I do actually see women more now coming forward. So occupational health is maybe someone's on sick leave and you review them to see if they fit to go back to work. But now I'm actually getting referred people with menopause who are looking for adjustments in work to help with their menopause. And that's really good to see that, because you, people should be able to come forward and say, I need some help. But a lot of the time they haven't said why they need the help and they're coming to see me, their company's referred them on. And we don't always have to say back to the company why, what the person is experiencing. So we don't always say that they're having menopausal symptoms, but we say what adjustments can help. So I think the expectation that, you know, it's great if women do feel like they can say either what they're experiencing, but the expectation shouldn't be there that it has to come from the employee, it has to come from the woman. It should be the company trying to make it a place where the person feels comfortable, regardless of whether what they want to say what it is or not.
Yeah, and then that is the policy led piece and how important that is, that if you work for a company that has a policy around fertility, around menopause, that's somewhere where you feel comfortable then accessing that and speaking up about that. You know, people have to share what they're comfortable sharing, but that sends out a very important message. Can we
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit then also about seeking help and that self-advocacy piece? Because there is also messaging that needs to change about women just struggling on. If we look at something like endometriosis, for example, the average wait time for diagnosis is 9 years. And a lot of that is attributed to the idea that women just live with painful periods and that is just a part of female life. And it shouldn't be looked on that way. It should be a symptom that is investigated. What's your advice on self-advocacy for women?
So I think one thing is the discussion around health topics. So I think menopause, it's absolutely brilliant. We see so much more about menopause now. And fertility, I think, is beginning to be more of a discussion. I definitely have more people coming to talk to me about fertility. But there's still topics. Endometriosis is definitely a topic we don't talk about enough. And I think when we're not talking about topics, that's when people don't find their voice. They don't come forward to say what they think they're experiencing. And especially, you know, just even coming to see a GP, which, you know, you should be able to come to your GP and say exactly how you feel, what you think it is, you know, whatever comes into your head. But I know that can be really hard for people. And I hear that in my talks that I give a lot, that someone's gone to their GP and they feel they've been shut down. So, you know, us having conversations and getting things into the main domain and getting them into social media as well can help with people, because it can help them find their voice and feel, well, actually, there's strength in numbers, there's other people experiencing this. So I think that's really important. But then also people having the tools to go to a healthcare professional and say, I think this is what it is because of all these symptoms, or I have this. So at my talks, I give women the menopause symptom questionnaire, which is just a very simple questionnaire with all the symptoms you can have in menopause. And you take yes or no, mild, moderate, severe. And I've had women, they've said to me, I've tried to talk to my GP about menopause and they feel it's not the menopause, maybe based on my age. And we know for menopause, age is but a number. So I say to them, okay, well, fill this out and bring it back to your GP and say, look, you know, this is what I think it is. And then same with endometriosis. You know, if you can write down your symptoms and say, look, I have all these symptoms, I really do feel that they add up and it could be endometriosis. It's much harder to be sort of turned away when you have that information. And that's why I say information is empowerment, because it empowers you to find your voice and go to a healthcare professional and say, this is what I think it is. But I do think the sort of menopause revolution that's gone on, although, you know, there's certain factors I don't like about it in terms of it's becoming a little bit money-making in some places. It has helped really with women finding their voice and coming forward. There's things specifically around menopause, which I think we don't talk enough about, like urinary incontinence, that's a huge one, and sort of development of prolapses during menopause. And I think that's something we're beginning to talk about a little bit more. But I do think, you know, bringing up topics and making them, as you're doing, mainstream than people are willing to talk about them. Because we happily go into the GP and talk about cholesterol and blood pressure. And okay, it's not as maybe intimate, but it's because we hear about them on a daily basis.
Yeah, and we consider them to be a health issue. I often give the advice that you need to find a GP that you trust and that you feel you are listened to with. But I often get emails and messages online from people, particularly around the country, saying that's not an option. And particularly to access a female GP isn't an option. So we have a way to go with that, don't we?
Definitely. And I do that here. I hear that from my talks. And I run a menopause service in Grafton Medical where I'm a GP. And you don't have to be a patient of the practice. You can come in as an external patient. And a good few of the patients have gone through two or three GPs before they've got to me. And sometimes come in as really upsetting, but they can be really upset because they found that they've just been told it's not menopause. It's been put on an antidepressant. And it doesn't mean it is always menopause, but it's definitely being heard makes such a big difference to people. So I definitely see that. And would never want to diss my GP colleagues, but I do think, GPs have an interest in different things. So sometimes, unfortunately, it is trying to find a GP that has an interest in the health topic that you have. And it is about educating ourselves as well. And I understand that there's certain parts of the country where the local GP maybe doesn't know, that's not a special interest of theirs, but it's not a topic they're interested in. I mean, menopause is a natural cycle, part of our cycle. It should be something we're all interested in, but it seems to be that there are areas that different GPs are interested in. So I suppose if you have the option to travel somewhere else and meet a different GP, that sometimes has to be the option.
But as you say, don't be afraid to keep gathering information, be it online or keeping a track of your symptoms. And just keep pushing. We all know our own bodies. You're an expert on your own body. Nobody can really tell you what is pain to you or what isn't. If you're not getting the answers that you want, then keep asking, even if going to a different GP is not necessarily an option. Can I ask you finally, seeing as you are so menopause focused, we are indeed talking about menopause a lot more now, but there is still an issue with access to HRT. It's still not free, although that was promised at the last election, and there still is a huge shortage of HRT. Where are we with that, although it is not your responsibility to fix these things?
I mean, patch shortages are still a huge problem, and the patches we're getting instead of the patches we like are not great. So that's still a huge problem. The free HRT will be great when it comes in, and obviously there's been so much talk about that. There are other options. So there are gels and sprays, and actually my preferred option is the spray. So I think the thing is, there's shortages. The gels and spray, there's no shortage at the moment. So if you are finding it difficult with the patch, that you can't get the patch, or it's not absorbing because the patches aren't as good as the original ones, so they're not working quite as well, then just, go back to your initial prescriber and just ask them to switch to something different. Obviously, it's not ideal to be switching around, but the two other options, the gel and the spray, are actually really good options. So there's, don't be left without your HRT. Go back to whoever is your provider. I get women just to email me and just say, I can't get my patch, and I switch them over. There's no big palaver of needing to come in and see me, really. It's I can switch them over by email. Because the dosing is the same. It's the same medication at the end of the day. It's just a different formulation.
Yeah, like we said, with the policy-led care, it sends out a message. And I think not having free HRT for 2025, as was promised, and having a shortage of patches also sends out a message which feeds into the disparity, which is why we started this conversation in the first place. But Louise, you are out there fighting the good fight. People can get themselves informed and armed with information at your website, informed.ie. You are at Grafton Medical in Dublin, and you also host the Lady Bites podcast with the Irish Heart Foundation. Dr. Louise Fitzgerald, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Emer Daly of Daily Wellbeing is back with the latest in health and wellness news. Emer, you're very welcome.
Thank you. I absolutely love coming here and bringing some good news stories to the table.
and you are fresh from your International Women's Day event in Bective Mill in Meath. How did that go?
It was absolutely fabulous. Like, I'm feeling very empowered after it. My sister Niamh and I did some yoga as part of a wider retreat. There was cacao, there was dancing to Chaka Khan. It was very just fun, girly vibes, but left feeling really empowered.
It's a lovely venue, actually, isn't it? Because you've got the dome. It was a sound bath. I did that there. I presume that's where your yoga was on.
Yeah.
You've got the river alongside it and then hot box sauna. So it's worth the trip.
Really worth the trip.
Nearby.
It's like a little fairy tale out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I drove an hour and it was worth the drive.
It's always worth the drive.
Let's get into some of the stories. Your first story, Emirates are to become the world's first autism certified airline.
Yeah, this is a really great story to read. So Emirates are introducing a global autism friendly certificate for in-flight experience. And they just want everybody who has autistic children or is an autistic individual to feel really comfortable and safe attending one of their flights. So they've undergone 30,000 staff, both in the air and on the ground, going through trainings, delivery programs, just to really make sure that everybody coming on board their flight feels safe and secure. So some of the findings have shown that 78% of families with autistic members are hesitant to travel, and 94% would travel more if airlines were more autism friendly. So there's some huge numbers there as to why this is so important. So Emirates are really setting the standard here for how we can make it as inclusive as possible for autistic members or families to come on their airlines. So they're doing things like making sure people are really prepared in advance of coming onto the flight, preparing autism-friendly downloadable guides for families to share with their children or for individuals as well. Because a lot of the things with coming to the airport, for most people as well, is the overwhelm of, like, I don't know what's going to happen. So allowing autism children or individuals know the process from checking in, getting on the plane, what's going to happen, can just really ease some of that stress a lot. So some of the things that they're going to be bringing in is, when you're in the waiting room, they're going to have kind of a nice area for sensory lighting, comfortable seating, noise cancelling headphones to chill out and calm before your flight. And then when you get onto your flight, they'll have things like stress balls, free selection of seats, which I think is amazing for the individuals and their family. And then also in-flight entertainment, noise cancelling headphones, which we've mentioned already. But this is something for other airlines to take inspiration from. And hopefully we see this across many other airlines after this.
And I think it's worth pointing out that we did a lovely piece on the show with Dublin Airport, and they are autism friendly and they do provide a lot of what Emirates are doing. So you can come and do a run through ahead of travel.
Yeah.
And we'll be brought all the way to the security gate so that you're not coming up on the day of travel for the first time. So it's great to see, especially in a week where we had families, you know, sleeping out to demand for school places. It is good to hear some good news in this area. We still have a long way to go to have a fully inclusive society, but this is indeed a good news story, which is what you promised us, Emer. So thank you. The next story is around gestational diabetes and the fact that that is on the rise here in Ireland.
Yes, gestational diabetes has doubled in Ireland over the past decade. And this was announced on the Baby Tribe podcast that Fionnuala Brannock at the Rotunda Hospital released. For anybody who doesn't know, gestational diabetes is something that can come about during pregnancy. And criteria for meeting gestational diabetes is a lot stricter now. And it's really just showing that we've honed in on how we're kind of managing that. But it's not something for us to be kind of afraid of. But some of the stats there is about 14% of women present with gestational diabetes. And that's about 1,400 women annually. Now, when that does happen in the Rotunda Hospital, they have a brilliant program there where you'll be set up with a nurse and you'll be monitored on your diet, your exercise, and you'll be checked in and looked after. And it's really just something to be made aware of so that we can best protect the individual and their baby as well throughout the rest of their pregnancy.
When I was pregnant, both my babies were considered to be bigger. And I'm only giving this as an anecdote, but babies are being born bigger, and often that can be an indicator of gestational diabetes. Mm-hmm. And the glucose tolerance test is what you take, and it's the maddest experience. You come in fasted and you're given jugs of Lucozade and then monitored to see how your body reacts after it. And you and other pregnant people are all just sitting drinking Lucozade and having the chats about pregnancy. But yes, I realise that it is, you know, has serious implications and does need to be monitored. But as you say, if it is something that you are diagnosed with, you will be hooked up with a team and given plenty of advice.
Mm-hmm. And the podcast, The Baby Tribe, I found out a lot about gestational diabetes. For anybody who does want to know more, maybe head over there and take a listen as well.
Fantastic. We've had an announcement this week of two new eating disorder teams.
We have. This is another really great news story. So we're going to see two new eating disorder teams coming up in 2025. So one of them will focus on children and teens, mainly in the Midwest. So covering Limerick, Clare and the surrounding areas there. And then we'll also have a supporting team for adults in counties like Louth, Meath, Longford, Westmeath, Laois and Offaly. These services haven't been there before. So this is really, really big. And why this matters is this is backed by 1.2 million in funding in 2025. And just to give you some insight into what we were seeing in 2024, Ireland saw a 33% increase in referrals for eating disorder services. But 62% of referrals were seen within 4 weeks, which is actually considered probably a short wait time when you look at other areas of waiting times. You might be looking at months. So we want to keep those standards up and really allow quick access for people who are going through an eating disorder awareness issue and just really making sure they get the support quickly so that we can treat them as best we can.
Yeah, and ultimately bring those waiting lists down even further. Mm-hmm. But it does send a really good message that this is a very serious issue that's been given attention, which is a really positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so now let's dive in to TikTok trends and castor oil. Tell me a little bit about that, because it has seeped into my consciousness and I have found myself wondering, do I need to buy castor oil?
I know, it's absolutely mad. Before we get into this, anything, any trends seen on TikToks need to be taken with a pinch of salt unless you've heard by an expert in the area. But castor oil is going absolutely mad. So it's great for things like hair growth, eyelash growth. But what people are doing at the moment is rubbing castor oil on their belly or inputting it into their belly button before they go asleep, putting maybe like a damp cloth over them with the castor oil, then going asleep and waking up the next morning and saying they are having amazing effects from the castor oil, like reduced bloating, more circulation. It's kind of like a little lymphatic drainage almost. And it's been seen to help with bowel movement as well. Everything works differently for different people, but castor oil is set to be on the rise in 2025 as well.
For more on Emer, you can go to @daily_wellbeing on Instagram, Emer Daily, D-A-L-Y. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, just a warning that our next topic is indeed an important one, but as Jenny Keane is a sex educator, the topic will, of course, have adult themes. Now, Jenny Keane is a professionally trained, trauma-certified, holistic sex educator. Jenny started out on a mission to ignite a sexual revolution in Ireland, and now thousands of people here and across the globe have participated in her world-renowned online sex education workshops and attended her live shows. She's just been announced as a headliner at this year's Wellfest, and she joins me in studio now. Jenny, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much. That's a nice intro. Thank you.
And you have come so far since starting out with that revolution. Yeah. Do you feel a change in the air?
I absolutely do. I think even in the last 4 years since I went online, I've noticed such a difference in the way that people talk to me, even in interviews, the questions that I get asked now. I'll never forget one of the very first interviews I did in 2020. Someone, before we got into the questions, this person said, "I'm not going to be able to say the V word, just so you know." And I was like, vagina? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, okay, how about I do the talking and you do the writing? And she was like, okay.
Yeah.
So whereas now I think we've come so much further than this. And I mean, I have people who have their mothers and like mothers and daughters come to my events together, really large group of girlfriends come, and they would tell me that like this is something they've never spoken about before until lockdown, and now they're coming to the in-person experiences that I run as well. So I mean, there's such a change and such an openness.
And I was at the Future Fertility Show at the weekend that was alongside the Future Beauty Show. So when I'd get a break from some of the panel talks, I went on a bit of a walk around. Yeah. And your stand was absolutely mobbed. And it's lovely to see. I mean, yeah. Laura Dowling also had her show on in the National Concert Hall. And I went to the one she had last year. Mm. And at it, they talk a lot about toys, and there's a stand where you can buy it, and it was mobbed. It's almost like women in particular are being given permission for pleasure.
Absolutely. Like, so I actually only opened my online toy shop just over a year ago, and it kind of came out of an evolution of just the amount of messages I was receiving every single week of people who were looking for recommendations, and I was sending them in 20 million different places, because the thing about the toy industry is that it's very unregulated, so it's really important that the products are body safe. And but also what I was finding was that people were lacking the education, so people were buying toys but not necessarily buying the correct toys for what they wanted to use them for. So whether that was for their own personal pleasure, or whether they wanted something more versatile that could be used for, you know, their personal pleasure plus partner pleasure, or whether it was just for partnered play. And then there's also very particular ways of using those toys. So I found like that with the platform that I had, my shop also transformed into, I suppose, an education first approach. And that's what we found at the weekend, like people that were at the pop-up stand and asking questions about like, and people are sharing their very personal, intimate lives with you, you know. And I think it's really important that there's a space where people can go that's shame free, and that's also educational, that you know you're getting the correct products for you. I'm even getting messages now coming in yesterday being like, we've used them and it's amazing, you know. So I think it's really important to get the right recommendations, because what happens is if you don't, you will buy a product or buy a toy, you might use it once, you might be like, that didn't work for me, or I didn't like that, put it in a drawer, and that drawer becomes like the drawer of shame, you know, that you never use again. And that kind of sits, you know, in your life, you know, as something that like, oh, like I don't, you know, that it kind of breeds something, you know. So getting something that's correct for you, that you're able to use and use well, I think is it changes your relationship with yourself and also your partner, right? It encourages those things like connection and intimacy and pleasure and fun and playfulness, you know?
And I do think that's really interesting that you mentioned the word shame, because even though we have come such a long way, as we started our conversation with, there still is a little bit of shame and stigma attached, particularly for women, isn't there? I mean, do you find some of them are happy to come to you and talk, but they're doing it a little bit whispered, and it's a very new territory for them?
Absolutely. But I think that's what works so well about the online world as well. Like, I think for me, I never thought what I was doing before I went online would translate to the online world. And what I realized was that it actually opens up the space to so many more people, the people who are nervous to approach, or who are nervous to even say, I have an issue, or I want to learn, right? Because there is a massive stigma when it comes to sex and education, especially for adults, right? So we kind of believe that sex is just something that we should know what we are doing and how to do it, and that if we seek education, it somehow means that we're not good at sex, which is absolutely detrimental, not just to our sexual selves, but to ourselves in general. I always say our sexuality is intrinsically linked to who we are and how we express ourselves in the world. So it's not a feeling of that. It's not just that you're not good at sex. It's that you're not good, or you're not good enough at all, right? There's like a full kind of circle here around it. So I think it's really important to have these spaces where people can approach in from their own comfort zone, right? And that's why the online workshops worked so well. You can do them from the comfort of your own home. You can press play, you can press pause, you know, you can turn it off and come back to it in your own time. And I think it's really important to have that. I mean, we even saw at the expo this weekend, you know, while you say like the place was mobbed, and yes, at times it was, we saw people walking past and, you know, they kind of glance and then they get a big fright, almost like, you know, a sex toy is going to come out and poke them in the eye, you know, and they kind of scurry off. But what you do see them do is kind of come back and, you know, look from a distance and then comes closer slowly and slower again. And sometimes they're only looking and sometimes they walk on. But I suppose my whole idea and intention behind what I do is to make everything extremely approachable, extremely relatable, and also look fun, warm and inviting, which I think was the feedback we really got from the weekend, you know.
Because you have been a guest on the show before. We spoke over the phone. This is the first time I've met you face to face.
During lockdown, I think.
Yeah. And we spoke about, people can listen back, your story, how you started. But we did speak about the link between our sexual health and our own well-being, because it is a very natural part of being a human. And obviously there's complexities to it. Mm-hmm. But having a healthy relationship with yourself and your own body and your sexual health is very important for your overall well-being.
Absolutely. It's the exact same as the importance we place on our physical well-being. The way that you're told, you know, make sure that you're eating well, make sure that you're exercising well. And this is like for your body, you know, having a relationship with the sexual part of ourselves is just another arm of what makes us human. You know, and if that's something that we ignore or we're disconnected from, that's okay. But it's also important to recognize that if you feel disconnected, you can connect again. And the way that you connect doesn't have to be scary or seem really out of your comfort zone. They can be very small steps, you know, like simply doing practices where you place your hands on your body and you just breathe into your body. So really, I always say that's the first part, right, when it comes to sex. I suppose my background is in somatic therapy, which is body-based practices. But if you think about, when we think about orgasm, that this is a sensation that we feel in and through our body. And if we are disconnected from our sexual part of ourselves, we're often disconnected from sensation, which means we often experience a sense of numbness. And one of the first things that we do to get back in touch with ourselves is start to, you know, inhabit our body again, right? And start to become aware of the sensations that we feel. And I always say, like, that's as simple as, you know, if you're sitting in work, you know, drink when your body is telling you it's thirsty. Go pee when your body is telling you you need to go pee, instead of going, oh, well, I'll wait till the 11:15 lunch break and then I'll pee, right? Because when you start to get involved with the conversation your body is trying to have with you and the signals it's sending you, it will start to send more, and this becomes easier and easier to kind of, I suppose, amplify the sensations that we feel, which then do link into our sexual world as well.
And so much has happened since we had that conversation. You had your big live show, and of course, there's no such thing as bad publicity. You were on every radio show, you're across every newspaper, because you struggled to find a venue to hold the sex toy show. Have things changed since then?
Yes and no. There are still some venues that won't go near you just because of the topic. And I mean, that's fair enough. And there's also certain times of the year. Like I was in one venue and they said, sorry, we actually have to move you because there's a panto on the following week. So it's just being careful about what's around that. So I suppose I've got better at asking questions when it comes to the venue and really making sure that we're kind of, you know, tight when it comes to what we're talking about. But I did 7 sold out shows last year. They're called Sex Talk. So they're a much more, they're a smaller, more immersive experience for people to explore topics that they probably don't have access to. And it's really about expanding your sexual horizons. So we explored topics like kink and rope play and, you know, sex skills for, you know, vulva pleasure or penis pleasure. And I had guest educators come from all over the world. I have a very large network of really fun friends that do a lot of amazing things. And what I found with these more intimate events events. So instead of having 1,500 people in them, we have 200 people in them. And they're much more immersive experiences where people really get a sense of, well, do I like this or do I not like it? And there's absolutely nowhere in Ireland that gives you a taste of something like this, you know? And I think it's really important because oftentimes when it comes to expanding our sexual horizons and exploring our sexual world, sometimes we might hear a topic like kink and we don't really know how to go any deeper into that, right? So this kind of event is really to kind of allow you to dip your toe in that topic in a very fun, accessible and also shame-free way. And they're really incredible conversations that get started as a result of this. People were coming with groups of friends or with their partners, and it's just been an incredible experience to watch that grow. And I actually only did these events as a result of becoming pregnant and not being able to have the energy for the larger shows. And then once I did the smaller shows, I was like, oh, like bigger isn't always better.
You mentioned becoming pregnant. Since then, you've gone on to become a parent, and people are quite obsessed with this idea that it must be very difficult for you now to fit it all in now that you have somebody sharing your bedroom, a smaller person.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I first announced that I was pregnant, I got loads of messages being like, well, you'll finally know what it's like for all of us now, you know? And I definitely understand where that comes from. But I think what people don't recognize is, I think because of my background and because of what I've studied, I have such a massive toolkit to draw from. And I'm also as well not afraid to meet sexual issues. So I believe that regardless of who we are, regardless of what age we are going to face multiple sexual issues at one point in our life or another. And those issues are going to completely vary depending on, you know, what age we are or what our circumstances are and our situations are, what situations are happening around us. And I really believe that education gives us the tools to be able to approach those sexual issues rather than to separate ourselves from them and think, oh my goodness, there's something wrong with me, and disconnect. So I have a lot of tools at my disposal that help me stay connected to my sexuality, even when there are huge shifts taking place, you know, like, you know, the experience of motherhood, you know.
And did having a baby change things? Did it make things different, difficult, challenging? I'm asking mainly not to delve into your personal life, but for other parents who are listening.
Yeah, because of the toolkit that I have, it didn't make things difficult at all. And this is because I know how to, as I said, connect with my sexuality, even when I have a lot of things going on. So, you know, I always give these tips to parents who are, you know, maybe approaching parenthood for the first time. Maybe they have several kids. It's the same tools that you can use. The first one is looking at making sex a priority. Now, this doesn't mean that you're having penetrative sex, right? Sometimes that is off the table. But how do you make sex a priority? And that looks at having a sexual, having really great sexual communication, or even just asking questions, right, to you and your partner. So when we make sex a priority, it looks like saying to each other, right, where is sex falling on your list of priorities right now in this moment? So if you've just had a baby, baby is number one. I think when you have children, baby stays number one for your entire life, right? But then what's next after that? Is it your physical well-being that's more important? Then what's after that? Is it making sure the house is clean? And then is it connecting with your partner, right? And when you make that list and you check in with that list over and over again, like every 2 weeks or so, you'll actually find that those priorities start to shift. So right in the very beginning, I remember my physical well-being was much more important. So I was making time when I did have those, like, you know, a 20 minute break or whatever, to lie on the floor, to connect to my body, to do very small breathwork practices that supported my pelvic floor. And that was more important than connecting my partner. So I made sure that that was happening before that, right? And then later on, I found myself getting really stressed because I was constantly trying to, like, keep up with the laundry. I was getting my partner to keep up with the laundry. And when we wrote our list of priorities, we both realized that the housework and the laundry was below connecting with each other. So then it was something that we were able to go, do you know what? Physical well-being is still really important, but actually our connection to each other is more important than the housework. So instead of trying to clean the entire house, let's sit down and have a 20-minute conversation with each other, or a 20-minute hug, or, you know, well, not 20-minute hug, but like, you know, where we're really with each other when we're present. So doing something like that is makes it so simple to understand where you're at. And what you're also doing is you're allowing that sexuality to still be alive between you because you are communicating about it, right? You might not necessarily be doing anything, but that line of communication is open, which means that, I suppose, that sexual channel is still open as well.
Yeah, that conscious living that you touched on. You are headlining Wellfest. Yeah. What can people expect from you on stage at Wellfest?
I know, I'm so excited. So I'm actually teaching a Tantra yoga class on the main stage. I haven't taught Tantra yoga since before I got pregnant. So this is kind of like, you know, the first foray into this since having a baby. And I have a really large Tantra yoga community who, I suppose, were with me all through lockdown. The practice is really, really incredible. A lot of people think Tantra yoga is to do with sex, but actually that's not true at all. Tantra yoga is really rooted in, and the practice that I teach is rooted in, traditional Hatha yoga and Kundalini yoga. Tantric sex is, I suppose, a spiritual form of sex, which actually has nothing to do with Tantra yoga at all, and definitely nothing to do with what I'll be teaching on stage, so people don't have to worry. But I probably should say that because my background is also in sexual education as well. But I will say that Tantra yoga has an amazing way of supporting your sexuality because it really sees the pelvis as the epicenter of the practice. So if you've ever practiced with me before, there's a lot of work on breath work, on the pelvic diaphragm, on the diaphragm in general. And then also it's an incredible way to reduce stress. I also kind of bring in practices from somatic therapy as well. So what people were finding during lockdown was that they had a really adaptive nervous system. So if they were having these heightened moments of stress or overwhelm, or, you know, experiences with the unknown, they were able to manage it because their body was adaptive because of this practice. So I know a lot of people who already do Tantra with me are really excited for it to be back, and I'm really excited to be on the main stage and share that. And then I'm also giving one of the sex talks that I give as well. So there'll be a lot of fun, a lot of tips, a lot of toys.
Good stuff. Well, it is on the 10th and 11th of May. For more, you can go to wellfest.ie, and you'll find out more about Jenny's upcoming shows at jennykeen.com and also omoment.com. That's ohmoment.com. Jenny Keen, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to all my guests, to my producer, Maurice O'Sullivan, and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.